JB, the floor is yours. We're very much looking forward to hearing from you.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Does everybody hear me and see the slides?
Looks
Please
like you're
go
coming
on.
through loud and clear.
Yes.
Okay. So the topic today that I wanted to talk about was the way we can adapt to a situation to identify a problem and design a corresponding project. So it's pretty basic. Mr. Kaisan, sorry, who has been presenting something relatively similar, has been very much in detail into the process of designing a project, and I thank him for this. But today, what I would like to do is to trace something a bit more personal, something based on empirical knowledge. And empirical knowledge means something based on experience and observation, not only on theory and reasoning. So it's a bit away from the traditional NGO language, first because I don't have this personal background of working in an NGO or studying in the development area. And second, because I think it would put things more back into their general context. So I divided the presentation as in two parts. One is to analyze basically what I mean by adapting the situation of a community and design a corresponding and needed project. So a few slides about that. And then I will illustrate according to what we do in Kulen Mountain, Siem Reap province, these first slides. So the first one is, I would say, to adapt, which means observing. Observing is to get to know, to get the information, to process information from the field. And this has a few requirements. The first is obviously time. It takes time to know an area. It takes also more time, especially if you are a foreigner. And I think all the non-Cambodian present here today are aware of this, that the gap culture is quite big between the Western world and Southeast Asia. So it takes a time to digest the information, the culture, and to process them. Then, of course, you need the team, the contact person on the field, the network of people and partner to be able to set up such a project. And then you need trust, because if you have no trust, if you have twisted relation or people that are playing around, then of course it doesn't work. So this first phase provides you information. But I think the main main point here is that you have to listen. You have to adapt to what I call the people. In general, I'm not targeting any special community or any group of people in that term, but this is really important to be active just by listening, and then you can move to the second phase, to the next phase. During this phase of listening and observing, I think it's also very important not to make any promises or engagement, because when they see an organization, when villagers or any community on a large definition of that term, when they see some organization or even some organization staff coming and they have expectation, they have hopes, which is quite understandable. But when you are first in this phase of listening and observing, you should not make any promises, any engagements, because you never know if it's going to happen until you have all the next phases put together, which I'm going to detail further on. So this is also quite important from my experience. And then another point about this first phase is to get the other source of information, not only from the field, but from other other sources, such as work that has been done before in this particular area where you work, or on the same theme, or any document that can help you. I think this would be the first attitude, the first phase for setting up a project. Situation. So situation, of course, by definition, any situation changes. So you have different factors to consider. First is the time factor, because if you make an assessment of a situation, the changes between the assessment and the implementation can happen. If you implement the project, you can have changes during the implementation of this project. For example, items or activities are less needed or are not needed anymore, or you have other actors coming to implement similar activities or complementary activities. So this has to be taken into consideration. Also, the main objective of this phase, I would say, is to identify the problems. So again, Thijs Haan has explained that very well, and I'm not going into detail, but I think his presentation that I rewatched yesterday, thanks to the Southeast Asia website, show very well that the root problem, the root causes, the core problem, and the effect. And then all the tools that you can use to during this phase of analyzing the situation, such as the need assessment, so the surveys, interview, focus group. But you also, and this is very important, need to do field verification. I'm thinking about an example of an assessment that we did 2 years ago, before we started a hygiene and sanitation project in 4 schools, which is still ongoing. We had a questionnaire. We were interviewing maximum of kids in each schools and teachers. And by interviewing the kids, one of the questions was, do you have toilets in your house? And of course, most of them didn't. Some of them did. And when you go and check the toilet, sometimes it's a non-functioning toilet. It's just a toilet with no wall. It's full of soil and dirt, and it doesn't work. So yes, they have a toilet, but they can't use it. So this is very important to have some field verification, not only those tools that we all use. Also, when you do the questions, I think leading questions can also be very, they are leading to some, of course, by definition, to some answers. And neutral questions should be, if possible, used, because in many cases, people don't dare to say, or if you have a leading question, then they will say they will answer the way you want. So this is also quite important to take into consideration. Also, the interpretation of the problem can be different according to if you are from the NGO, from the civil society, from the local authority, or from the beneficiary that you want to address yourself as an NGO worker. So, one example that I will show you later is the Chamkar, the field that we have in Kulen. For us, it's a problem because it's this destruction of the forest of the national park. But for them, it's a solution. They want to cultivate more. They want to grow more rice and cashew nuts. So, of course, what we see is not the same. I mean, we see the same. We have a different interpretation. So the whole thing has to be considered and also see it as the big picture. I think that would be The way to summarize this slide is to try to see the big pictures in and out, who is seeing what, who is doing what. And this, again, takes a lot of time. And also, in that phase of work, start to consider the human and financial resource and skills from the NGO, but also from the counterpart, because NGO by itself, as far as I have experienced it, it's, if it's too much disconnected from the local, not only the beneficiary, but a network of local partner that are not necessarily the local authority. It's important to work with them, but not only, and it's very important to have a network of local partners so you can share the knowledge. So in our case, for example, we have the teachers, we have the community, forestry members, and the branches. This slide is about the community. So community has, to me, it's a word, I mean, English is not my first language, as you can hear, but it's a word that is being used and used and used, and sometimes I think overused. So I tried to, I didn't look for any definition on the web or in any dictionary. I just wanted to have my personal thought about this word, and maybe we can share that later. But by definition, to me, a community doesn't include everyone. And that's a bit a misleading word, because by community, we think, oh, everybody in the village and so on. But it's not as simple as this, because to me, it's targeting a certain population with ripple effects, such as when you work in schools, you target the students and the teacher, but also their parents. If you work in agriculture, for example, you target the farmer and, of course, their family. So every project is targeting a community, but not the community, I would say. So when you do define a project, you will have to think about who will be the first benefiting and who will be the secondary beneficiary. And I think this thoughts is this thoughts put your project into a larger perspective, and it helps to consider all the effects, and also on a longer term, on a time scale. Also, if you choose a community, by automatically you exclude others, right? So you have to explain this in your proposal, in your relation with the beneficiary and with the people that are not benefiting from your project. So you have to explain it, and this can be explained by different factors. You have the emergency factors, for example. You have the priority factors. You have, of course, financial and human limited resource. You have also people that are volunteering to participate to some project, or in some cases, something which is more compulsory. And also you have the geographical / territorial range of your action. There might be more, but that's the one I thought about. I think by creating the link between the identified problem, the targeted population, the solution to implement, and the human and financial resource, this allows you to design the project. So design the project. So these are a series of bullet points in two slides. Then I will present you some more visual slides, but these ones are just bullet points to see how we could design a project. So first, ask yourself the main questions: how to implement the project, who is going to implement the project, so the resources, the team, the partner, how long, is it a quick impact project, or is it on a longer term to be also efficient, what kind of activities and where, and of course define the goals. I would refer again to Mr. Tai San's presentation about the tree analysis, because he has shown very well how the root cause can be transformed into objectives, how the core problem can be transformed into the goals, and how the effects should be reversed into the long-term impact. And of course, you have to define some results that you are expecting. So to summarize, think large. Who do you target, firstly, secondary? Think consequences. If you choose some, you're excluding others. So what are the effects about these choices, and how do you deal with that? Think sustainability, for example, is one of the examples, but it's always better to recruit locally. So you transfer the knowledge to the villagers. If the staff move away from your project or from your organization, then at least the experience and the knowledge that this person has got from all those months or years of work stays in the village, and it will be shared at least in his family or neighbors and so on. Think staff and partner, because the project should also improve their skills. It's a great opportunity for us to build experience on the people we're working with. Think local authorities, because nothing really work well if we don't collaborate with them. Think main goal and objective to achieve a project, but you need flexibility, all right? Because as I said, situations changes, and I think we all went through the COVID, and we know that what it means, that you have to adapt, you have to be flexible, and also thing to be convincing, not only for your donors, but for the people you are working with, because this is quite important to show the necessity of your project. The last slide about this first part is to give us, again, on a very personal point of view, what I usually use when I present the project. Of course, it changes a little bit and according to the project and the donors and the activity, but basically this is my table of contents for the project that I try to propose with our team. The basics first, the summary, and then you have a very short chapter about the goal, the objective, and the expected result. You have a project description with the location, the statement of underlying needs and issues, the context and the challenges of the project history, if you have the first phase or previous organization working in the same field, and then the partner involvement. You have to show also that your organization is able to implement this project. You also have to show the human resource and the technical means that you plan to use for this project. For the implementation, and this I would contradict myself a little bit, but I think that the logical framework, which is very used in the NGO world, is a very good tool, because in one table it can show what are the objectives, what are the project activity corresponding to this objective, what are the expected results, what are the indicators to verify the results, and what are the source and means of verification. So again, this kind of document in a project proposal is a very good way to show that your project is well set up, well thought, and there is not only means to implement it, but to monitor to show to follow it up. Monitoring and evaluation, evaluation of the risk, what measure can you use and how long, and for the sustainability as well. All this also is important to include in your project proposal. The contact, the budget. In the budget, I would also include some salaries, because in some cases, some donors, they don't want to pay for salaries. They think activities are just done by themselves, and they don't want to pay for any expenses related to wages. So I'm fighting in every project to keep that, because of course nothing can be done with staff which is not well paid. So this is quite important. You don't have to put them all, of course, but at least the maximum of them, or the one, of course, related to the corresponding project. You have to think about some renewal of some materials, because materials tends to be broken after a few years. So you take the opportunity to, you know, renew, buy a new computer, a new motorbike, or a new printer, or whatever you need. So you need an assessment of, you need a vision of all your assets in terms of computer, vehicles, or whatever. So we do, for example, us, we have a list, and we know where we bought, how much we bought, and if it's broken, then it's out of the list, we need another one, and so on. But also some general costs should be included into the budget, because renting an office, paying for internet, paying for a guard, paying for the food, or these are costs that usually people, donors, are not willing to pay, which is understandable in a way. But you, if you can, you can find a way to put it, because otherwise how can you pay for them? So this is what I would also include. I would, for the project budget, I would also show what you have as own expense, because again, you cannot ask for all the costs to be paid by the particular project. You have to compare that. You have to show that also your organization is paying through different funding some own expenses. So this first part is over. I will go quickly through the next slides to show you an illustration of, try to show you an illustration of how we implement all this activity in Kulen National Park in Siem Reap province. So you're, for those who are in Siem Reap, maybe more familiar with this area, Siem Reap town, Atara zone in Angkor, and the Kulen National Park, which is defined by the green line. And then you have other protected areas which are related to the park. So just in there, we have to work with three different entities, governmental entities for us at Sahara, the Ministry of Environment, and the local authority. So just to work in Kulen National Park, implementing all this activity, we have to get two MOUs with two main governmental agencies. Next one is a bit big, I think. Oops, I think it's stuck. Oh yeah, okay. National park. So it's a national park. The red line here is corresponding to the green one on the previous slide. And most of the people are living on the south part of Kulen Plateau, which is this one. The park continues towards Cabazpin, which is here, and then you have a forested area around here. But this is the area where we mostly work, and it's populated by more than 4,700 people. Nine of the villages are in one commune, and one is in the other one. As you might know, Trompulen was one of the siege of one of the early Angkorian capital. So this is of course one of our big interests in ADF, but I'm not gonna go too much in detail about archaeological research and problematic today. I just want to take the opportunity to show you a few slides showing the last results of the LIDAR operation we did a few years back, or 10 years already, and then again in 2015, and then a lot of field verification in the forest to check all the features, all the dam, all the ponds, all the platforms and mounds that we saw thanks to the LIDAR, and that allowed us to discover this massive grid, which is linking the archaeological sites that we previously know together. So, for example, we have the unfinished reservoir here, the unfinished Baha'i, we have the mountain temple here, we have the royal palace here, and a few other temples around. But what we didn't know is those big axes made of earth and dam defining the city and covering more than 40 to 50 square kilometers. So it was a massive discovery, of course. This is just a view of excavation we did back in 2009 about the mountain temple, Pasat Onchen. And another one here about another kind of sites, which are the rock shelters corresponding to hermit, aisei, like we say in Cambodian, that were coming for meditation, to isolate themselves from the world and to say to stay in places that they sometimes decorated with ponds and carvings and inscriptions and bas-reliefs and so on. So we've been working a lot on this. These sites are a bit later, 10th to 12th, 13th century, whereas the capital that I show you right before is from the early 9th century. So by working on all these sites, we're trying to have an idea of how the occupation over the centuries happened in Kulen. Now, if we take all these data and we apply to a daily life, to what's going on in Kulen, for example, well, we can see that, for example, all these mounds here that are right into a long-term village. And what I mean right is really inside the village. This is the pagoda. This is our house is right here. The school is right here. The health center is right here. So all these ancient mounds were completely unknown before we had the chance to do the LIDAR. And we have excavated them without any answers about their function. But the point here is to show you that, okay, there is archaeological site, there is a project of road development, which is now ongoing and almost finished for that section actually. But so we have to adapt, we have to talk to the population, we have to talk to the local authority to convince them to do a bypass, because the project, if it would follow the original road, would destroy those sites. So this has been done, thankfully. But the main problem we have in Kulen is this. It's the slash and burn. This is something that has been done for decades by the villagers, which were present in the mountain before it was even a national park. So it's a local tradition. The problem is that for the last 15 years, they have been so they do this to cultivate rice. They used to do it for cultivate rice. And the problem is for the last 15 years, they have been introducing cashew nuts together with the rice. So the plots that, for example, this one that has been burned by family, let's say those two ones, cut and burn, is usually grow when it was only rice, grow on over a period of a year, and then left over for regeneration for 10 years. It becomes something like this, and then it's cut again and cultivate again. But since they introduced the cashew nut, it becomes a permanent cashew nut farm, such as the one you have at the very bottom of this image. And then there is no more place to cultivate the rice. So they go deeper, deeper, deeper in the forest. And that's how, at least on the Kulen higher part, you have massive deforestation. So on the ground, this is how it looks like. And again, this is quite recent. With a drone view, you can see if you go higher, this is everywhere, okay? If you go on the lower land around Phnom Hop, which is the small mountain that you see when you go up the Kulen, you can see the problem is a bit different because it's not people from inside, it's people from outside. It's basically encroachment of illegal people going into a national park and cultivating lands without any law enforcement. So another problem identified is the illegal logging. This tends to be reduced now because less big trees to be cut, but also because of better law enforcement. So just over the years, we have been working on different land use studies, and these slides show you the forest cover loss and the agriculture expansion over a period of 16 years between 2001 and 2017. And there is, in the last estimation was that the national park from 37,370 hectares of protected area is only covered by 8,000 hectares of forested area. So there's only 20% of the park which is actually forested, and the rest has been deforested, mostly for agricultural purposes. So by staying there, by looking at all these issues and all these situation, okay, a very rich archaeological heritage, a very poor and isolated villages, which is less the case now because of road development, but it was extremely hard to reach the villages, and for some of them still a bit hard now. So it's a combination of different factors that we wanted to address. So first activities we've been doing is to implement to set up, demarcate, zoning and demarcation of archaeological protected area. So within, around the major archaeological sites, we decided together with our authority to define, demarcate area where people cannot cut the forest anymore. So of course, you're not super popular when you do this. Even though you employ some people, especially the outside workers. But this concept has been developed over the years. The last one we did is another one of 800 hectares around the temple that you see on the lower image here, north of Klakmul village. It's all a question of analyzing the situation and seeing what's best for the general good. So of course, it was a long-term process to explain the population that they didn't want to protect the forested area, the left of it. As you can see on the drone view, it's quite gone already, but at least we can protect that. We tolerate the cultivation of cashew nut, which is included into the protected area, but we don't, when I say we, it's us plus the Ministry of Environment, the rangers, we don't tolerate the new slash and burn, new deforestation anywhere actually, but even more in this area. You cannot do this without having some kind of conversation. This is our strategy, which is the result of years of work in Poulen. You cannot have only the stick if you don't have something else to propose. So in that particular meeting, which is the one from the bottom right picture, when the men understood that they could not cut the forest anymore, they all left. They all stood up and left. So it was quite shocking, but this is quite an isolated village. It shows that you talk, you explain, but some people are such in a mindset, they won't change. They just know how to do this and they won't change. But slowly you convince people that, you know, you can make money out of raising pigs, out of raising chicken. Of course, behavior changing is a long process, so it won't happen in a day, in a month, in a year. It will take a few years, but people will slowly change, and it will only work if you combine this with some law enforcement. If you let them grow chicken, grow vegetable or whatever, and raise pig or chicken, they will do this, but they will also continue to cut the forest. So yes, they do play cat and mouse with the rangers, but if you don't have any alternative, then there's no way it's working. So another alternative, well, it's not really an alternative, but another similar activity that is things and that also obviously are extremely needed. Firstly, is the water. So in Popel village, for example, we set up a water system for half of the village. Go to this one first. Yeah, we also enlarged an existing protected area, which is right behind the big Buddha of Poulen. You have what we call a CPA, Community Protected Area, which is under the management of the committee of this village. It was about 200 hectares, and we decided to, together with the local villager, to extend it to include most of the forest, which was threatened by the slash and burn cultivation that you can see all around, but also to include beautiful waterfalls, beautiful forested area. So this was a 2.5-year project, which is still ongoing. Demarcation has been done and so on, but there's still a lot of work. And because if you take that forest to be protected, which means they cannot cultivate anymore in this area, you need to again provide something as an alternative. So we decided together with the donors to set and the villagers, of course, firstly, to set up a community-based tourism center in this village. So by defining areas to be visited, by defining treks, by training, a lot of training about guiding and hospitality and history and cooking and hygiene. We set up tools that can be managed by these villagers and proposed to the visitors in this beautiful area. Another component is the support for the local handicraft, which is also displayed into the center. This is an example of a center, the one in Popel, with information signboards, facilities next to one of the four hidden waterfalls that are beautiful. Another CBTC set up in Anantom. Again, the idea is to provide alternative livelihood to the villagers. So propose that activities that are respectful to the environment of the park and that does not require any deforestation and that can provide income and also that can bring some extra knowledge to this population, because by setting up these centers, it's actually a way for us to give back to these friendly villagers the knowledge that we got from the archaeological excavation, so we can share it. We can say, okay, this is what we found. So it was still ongoing, the training about archaeological knowledge, and it's quite nice to do it after years of archaeological work. So again, this center is located in another village, Anantom, and is proposing tours to more historical area, temples, rock shelters, and so on. So if you want to have a very nice half day or full day trek in Kulen, let me know. I'll give you the contact of these two centers, and you have a beautiful day guided by these people and lunch pack and watered up if needed and so on. So this is the idea. Another way to give some alternative solution is to raise chicken and pig. This is quite popular in the area. We do more the pigs than the chicken. We've been doing this for almost 12 years now, following up every family. At one point, they can fly by themselves for sure, but at least at the beginning, you need some technical knowledge. Okay, same. We've been three years ago, thanks to a partnership with AgriSud, we've been able to expand very, very much this activity from 30, 40 families to 250 now, and mostly growing black ginger on fruit trees. And this black ginger is now processed into a drying facility, and the product will be diversified, will go to pepper, turmeric, and so on. So there's the whole dynamic of setting up groups of producers, farmers, and the link with the market, of course. Again, as an alternative to a situation which has been identified and addressed. Okay. Another way to address this situation of deforestation is to reforest and to educate the young generation. So we have also addressed that by setting up some tree nurseries in three villages. We actually finished the fourth one yesterday or today. And that over the 4 years allowed us to produce, to grow lots of trees, and that were all replanted in the park during reforestation activities such as these ones. So it's a way to, you know, bring awareness to the population, the young one, the older one. As I said before, you also need the law enforcement in a context like a national park, because there's always people that wanted to do illegal activities, hunting, more farms, or illegal logging. So we have to work very closely with the rangers of the national park. It's a limited team with limited resources, so we try to see what they need and push and help where we can. One of our first activity a few years ago was the training, because some of them have very low skills, so we need to train them about patrolling and so on. Something which is maybe more familiar to what you all do within the CLLC is working in schools, hygiene and sanitation. So again, this comes from an observation of situation in schools where you have a very low level of hygiene. For example, you have toilet, but you have no water, or you have no toilet, or you have no wash base, or no filters and so on. So this has been addressed by setting up a project focusing on two schools first, see how it goes, and then expanding on two more, and setting up infrastructures that are related to the hygiene problem, sanitation. So we have lots of activities related to that, lots of infrastructures built, and such as the water system, the wash bay, and protection of the sources as well, because that's where you can have some contamination. So lots of work has been done on four villages now. As I said, we were all hit by the COVID, so this project had to adapt. Brings me back to what I was saying before. Flexibility, okay, closed, schools are closed. What do we do? We have this project, hygiene and sanitation in schools. What can we do? So brainstorming, talks with the teachers, talks with the local authority, talks with the staff from the health center, and then definition of plan B to address the situation of COVID in Poulen. A long and a bit repetitive project for the team during March to December to have some prevention and hygiene session at the same time in those villages.
JB,
yes.
Forgive the interruption in the middle of a interesting presentation. I just want to do a little time check with you, and I want to make sure that we are leaving some time for the group to ask some questions as well.
Yes,
so,
yes, I have two more slides, and then I'll shut up.
Very good. Very well. Thank you.
So the last one is actually concerning what Southeast Asia Foundation is sponsoring, and it's mostly facilities that are lacking in school. Again, from observing what is missing in those schools, sometimes very basic schools, no facilities to treat the rubbish, no library, collapsing roof, no water system, no playground, nothing. So by doing all this activity, we like to make the schools like a nice place, so people, students are and kids are more happy to go. So that's the objective: efficiency for the education, better efficiency, and also attractiveness. No. I think that's my last slide. Basically, it's the same facilities, classroom, libraries, anything that can make the school a better place. And sometimes you have surprises, so you have to adapt. And in this case, just an illustration with some unexploded ornaments and in the facilities of the school. So adaptation, I think, is knowledge and flexibility is the key of this project, I would say. Thank you very much, and sorry for being so long.
Well, it's a big story, JB. It takes a little time.
Yes.
And if you want to bring us back there. I thank you immensely for the time and energy you put into making that presentation. And I've been up on Kulin two or three times now, spent quite a bit of time seeing these projects, and I think you do a amazing job of blending your archaeological imperatives, trying to preserve the national forest as well as all the historic pre Angkor ruins up there, and doing great social work, taking care of the people and blending that. So takes a little time to tell that story, but we do have a little time left, and I think it's a good time to open it to the floor. Anyone raise a hand or unmute yourself and chime in. What questions do we have for JB?
Well, I think you're all familiar with designing projects and making sure they are implemented correctly and successful. But I just wanted again to share my personal experience of how I approach this and how it is applied on the field.
Well, I will observe that your first step was listen to the people and build some trust. I think that kind of connection is essential. And you didn't mention it, but I think you're the only Westerner in your organization. All the rest are not only Cambodian people, but they're people from Kulin.
Yeah, yeah. We're actually one and a half, I would say, because Dave is only half time with us.
A few months. Dave Sandilands, yes, of course. Yeah.
But he's not here full time.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So once again, I salute your lead message is above all else, listen to the people, identify the needs, and then build the trusting working relationships. It's such a quiet group.
Well, before process the question, I have a question to ask. Thank you so much, Wei, for your time to prepare those presentations and also share the experience you had with people on Gulen. As we know, they're quite remote, right? And it's just very recent we can access to the roads and everything. I remember the first time I went there, I had to take a motorbike, sit on the back of someone's motorbike on a dirt bike road. So I just wondering, in a chain of like more than 10 years after you actually change your activity there to more development, do you see because there are some many villages on Gulen, so you has mentioned about the definition of ADF, what community is, you don't include everyone. So do you see the other people that you have not included will be part of the project in the future, or you haven't select them because they already in the notion of sustainability?
Do you mean that let me rephrase to make sure I understood correctly. Do you mean touch or didn't affect some of the community or some of a group of people in the previous time and that this particular group would be involved in any further activity?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
We're covering a lot of different aspects, as you have seen, from health issues to hygiene, to environment, to agriculture, to archaeology, to for example, we haven't worked at all with the monks, with the pagoda. So that's something I'm not sure we will go there because we might already do too many things, but that's something we could do. Even though there is not many pagodas in Kulen, at least the one in our village. For the rest, we are addressing a lot of issues. I'm not saying we are touching everybody. It's very particular, as you know, Kulen. There is one village we don't want to work because it's the waterfall village and it's populated by people that are not from Kulen and that are already, business savvy people making money which is good, with tourism and so on. So, but they are not from there. They actually came a few years ago, pushed away the original villagers and are making money out of tourism. So you really have to know all these things, because if you say, oh, let's, what about this village? Let's go and help the school. or let's go and do agriculture. They don't need you. They already have enough incomes. Also, one remark about this is the very, very poor, very, very poor. But I think I'll be interested to know what everybody thinks. But some of the very, very poor, we cannot, even though we push, we try, we can sometimes not include into our projects, especially when it comes to agriculture, because it means that you have to think ahead. You have to imagine next week, next month, next year, and you have to raise your chicken, you have to raise your pig, you have to grow your trees and so on. And unfortunately, some very poor family, they don't have this vision. They just live on a survival mode. And therefore they won't see the interest or the points of doing something that, you know, can help you. If you can at least have your meal for today, that's it. So this is one part of the community which is very hard to help. It's a bit paradoxical because it's the one that needs the most. But we can go around by, you know, making sure their kids go to school, get a proper hygiene, a proper education, and then slowly, from that angle, help them as well.
That's an interesting response, JB, because you've probably heard Sopal and me say this more than one time, that we're not there just to help people. We're there to help people help themselves. And I hear a little bit of that in your answer there, that some of these people are not participating in helping themselves. They just want help. And that has to be part of our selection criteria, I think. And you're very wise to keep that in mind, because we can't do everything for everyone.
No, we have been, you know, asking around who wants to do chicken, who wants to do pig, and some of them say, yes, let's do it. And then after a few months, you can see that it all goes south and they are not taking care of the animals. They eat them all and,
you know, thank you. Yeah, so, fun while it lasted.
Yeah, at least they had fun for a few days, but then that's not the point. So they're a bit saying one thing and doing something else. And not to me, you know, to the team and to the ADF team specialized into that problematic that has been working on this agriculture and animal raising for years. So the team knows how to present things to make sure there's chances of success, but sometimes it doesn't work because you have to, you deal with some villages that are extremely, that have an extremely narrow vision of the future, and they just live a daily basis. So it's also very tiring for the staff to, you know, to push, to make it happen, and then it just collapses. So it's difficult in some cases.
No, I think that's an important takeaway from what you're presenting here, is to make a very careful assessment of and pick your partners wisely, that we need people who will actually partner with us. And so Paul and I've unfortunately had a couple of examples where we found some NGO people that were just not good partner material. And fortunately, we find the vast majority, including all the people in the room here this morning, that are great partner material. But but we need to pay attention to that. Mm. Well, on behalf of the group, JB, thank you again for making the presentation well received, and an important reminder of how essential it is to build trust with the communities that we're serving.